Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where news meets insight and analysis and cuts through the noise. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, we bring you sharp conversations with the leaders, experts and decision makers who are shaping the world around us. No jargon, no spin, just the facts, the context and the stories that matter. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, how the regulator's tariff hike will hit your power bill. Joburg's traffic light crisis, why the chaos never ends. Cozy gaming, the global craze you can't ignore, and how smart tech is reshaping business communication. It's Friday, the 31st of January. Well, not entirely unexpected, South Africans will be hit with another electricity tariff hike, and while it's less than Eskom initially requested, it is still a significant increase. The National Energy Regulator granting a 12.7% increase for 25-26. Further hikes are planned over the next 2 years. Businesses and households, I don't need to tell you, are already struggling with the cost of power, and all will have to dig deeper into their pockets. Joining us now is David McDonald, Chief Executive Officer of Solar Africa, a leading voice in the renewable energy sector. David, a very warm welcome to you. Before we talk about the increase, note out from Eskom today that effectively says we face the risk of more rotational blackouts at the weekend after Eskom has depleted its reserves because of extended plant breakdowns. What's your assessment? Is this unexpected?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. No, definitely not unexpected. You know, if we're talking about the actual tariff increase, it's definitely been Eskom's modus operandi over the past few years to, you know, have requested inflated price hikes. To land on a more realistic double-digit number. So definitely not unexpected. With regards to the load shedding, I think everybody is in consensus here that it was coming back. So definitely not a surprise. I think the timing of the notice and the escalations, I think, is not great for Eskom. But definitely not a surprise to the market.
All right, 12.7% in terms of the increase granted by NERSA. How does this translate, in your opinion, into real costs for businesses and households? The pressure just ratchets up, doesn't it?
100%. I think it is a fine balance, and I do believe that NERSA have definitely applied themselves to this increase. A fine balance between, you know, allowing Eskom that financial stability and being able to capture more revenue versus affordability for the customer. But when it gets to the rands and cents and how it hits the consumer, it's definitely going to be down to how Eskom apply that into their tariff structures. I do think that majority of these price hikes are going to essentially affect the primary and secondary sectors more than it will affect the end users. Specifically with Eskom applying for their retail tariff plan, which would kind of move more of the electricity cost to a fixed income base versus variable. But to give you some context, if we had to take an industrial user, a 1 MVA user, it would more than likely increase his electricity spend by about 2.3 million rand in a year. And if we look at sector workers earning around 50 rand an hour, you know, that equates to about 22 permanent jobs per annum. So, you know, either the price hikes get passed on to the consumer through, you know, whatever product that these sectors are producing, or, you know, the companies are going to have to find other ways and means to reduce their costs. There are abilities for large entities to reduce this through renewable energies, and Eskom are, you know, promoting those on a variable basis. Mm. But definitely, certainly, it's going to have a major impact.
And would you agree that maybe businesses, to your point, are starting to reach some degree of breaking point here. We've got above inflation increases expected for the next couple of years. Are we at the point now where what I think you're saying is where people, businesses, particularly big businesses, are starting to move away from Eskom entirely?
I think everyone would love the ability to have that independence and have that in their control. Unfortunately, I don't think it is possible, and I don't think it's the best move for the country. But to a certain degree, you know, going out to large IPPs, buying energy, forward energy, at really affordable rates, right? That's 50-60% discount to what Eskom's offering at this stage. But we still need Eskom to manage that infrastructure and to grow that infrastructure. And they can't do that, you know, if they're not financially stable, if they aren't, you know, collecting their revenue. Essentially, their cost of debt is going up, and that spirals out of control. So that's why I said, there's a fine balance. Mm. And, you know, the private sector working with the public sector here for the betterment of South Africa in the long run. And I think NERSA are aware of that, and they've definitely applied, you know, thought process in this increase.
And in that respect, a lot of us would feel that we're just stuck in an endless cycle. Eskom asks for massive increases, NERSA reduces them, the price is still well above the rate of inflation. Is there a sense maybe that this is a strategy just to soften the blow here?
Definitely. I think from Eskom's perspective, you know, as I said, it's been their modus operandi. And I think, you know, NERSA are in a tough spot where, you know, they can't obviously grant the 36. I think that would kill off South Africa as a whole. But essentially, you know, balancing that revenue for Eskom and obviously the end consumer. So I do think it is a way to land a softer blow. Mm. I do expect Eskom to challenge the 26 and 27 increases. You know, 5.3 and 6.9 is definitely not going to be sustainable for them. So we can definitely see, you know, pushback, expect those to go up towards, you know, the double digits.
So, David, the pivot to renewables is well down the road, but one of the problems is that smaller businesses, and I guess households as well, often can't afford the upfront cost of renewables. How do they deal with that particular issue?
So they are, the energy sector has come a long way in the past 3 to 5 years. There are multiple solutions for, you know, larger users as well as smaller users, all on a finance basis. We are moving to a virtual electricity world where smaller users are getting access to renewable energy or IPPs, you know, building at scale. And that's all through Eskom infrastructure, right? And I don't think we can discount that. I think what's been good about this determination was that it's the first time that NERSA has actually applied it in three different sectors, so generation, distribution, and transmission, and have ring-fenced those. So traditionally, Eskom has underspent for the last 10 to 15 years on the transmission side, and now that's being monitored and that's being capped. So we can expect that revenue that's generated there to be invested back into infrastructure, which would allow IPPs to come onto the network, which would allow cheaper power through to the end consumer.
Just a final one. Do you think that there is enough policy support to encourage business to shift to renewables? There is a sense that there's maybe still too much bureaucracy, too much red tape.
Definitely. I think that's something that, you know, the efficiency of how we process these things has got to improve. Eskom came out about 18 months ago with some mandated deadlines. They haven't been able to stick to that, unfortunately. And that's, you know, mainly due to constraints on the grid, you know, multiple grid studies having to be done. The policies are there. I just don't think they're being implemented correctly. I think the flow through from Eskom into the municipalities is a real sticking point for the end consumer. You know, for businesses that are direct Eskom users, those policies are there. But within the municipalities, it's definitely not there, which is going to be our struggle in the next 4 to 5 years. I mean, it's relevant with the 110 billion rand that's owed to Eskom from the municipalities.
Well, let's brace ourselves for potential stage 4 load shedding this weekend. My thanks to David McDonald, Chief Executive Officer of Solar Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, to many of us, to the naked eye, Johannesburg's road infrastructure would appear to be crumbling. Potholes, congestion, failing traffic lights have all become part of daily life for residents and businesses. And freight operators are particularly hard hit with damaged roads, increasing costs and causing major delay in the country's biggest economic hub. The Johannesburg Roads Agency is responsible for fixing this mess, but the question is it delivering, or is it simply making excuses while the city's road network deteriorates further? Well, hopefully some answers from Sipho Nhlapo, who's the acting head of Department of Mobility and Freight at the JRA. Mr. Nhlapo, welcome and thank you very much for joining me. You are well aware that businesses are losing millions due to damaged vehicles and delays. What do you say to those people who feel abandoned by the city?
Okay, thanks, Jeremy. I think they are not abandoned by the city. They are not abandoned by any agency of the city. But the city in itself operates within an environment of a society. For an example, I'll make an example with traffic lights. If we put a traffic light on the ground, that is working, that is perfectly working. However, we are confronted with a situation whereby some people, and some of them are probably in the businesses, are in the industry itself, they steal the cable that was intended to make sure that the network operates fully to benefit every citizen of the city. It's a challenge that we are working with. Secondly, you will realize, even with these circumstances that we have, there's a lot of things that the city has been doing, but especially the JRA in terms of the roads. If you look at the M1, the M2, the Joe Slovo Road, we've been resurfacing those. And some of these results, how do we know that they are yielding certain positive results, Jeremy? Is that when you look at the current TomTom and INRIX traffic congestion studies that they do across the year, across more than 500 cities across the world, you will quickly realize that Johannesburg does not even crack the top 10 of the worst traffic or congested cities across the world. Even in Africa, even in South Africa, we're not even anywhere near the highest number. Simply means certain things are working. And then if somebody was then operating as a freight company, they will know very well that when they hit Johannesburg roads, the chances are high that they'll navigate that city quicker than many other cities in South Africa. You can check that TomTom or INRIX
Mr. Nhlapo, yes. You've raised a number of issues. Let me pick you up on a few. First of all, let's talk about the traffic lights and the stolen cables. Yes. Are you suggesting to me that the city, that the JRA is powerless to act, that we've just got to live with the problem because the cables will always be stolen?
Never. That should never even be a point. I've seen other cities go and try to put the stop sign. I've heard many people saying, why don't you just make the traffic lights theft proof. My point first is, let's allow the society or the people not to steal the traffic light. Because if you put a traffic light there and then we maintain it the way we should be maintaining it, it can take a very nicely 30 years on the ground without any problem. So we need to deal firstly with those societal issues. But on our side, we are not sitting down and saying traffic lights, they steal cable. Over the years, we've been recabling a lot of our traffic lights. We've done very well there. And what we've done when we recable our traffic lights, Jeremy, we have reduced the content of copper in those traffic lights so that even if somebody were to steal, the yield is very little. So that is an initiative that we've been doing for years. We still need to do more. We're operating about 2,000 sites that are all cabled, Jeremy. That's what we've done. Secondly, what we've done, we have tested some of the cable that is called, it's copper aluminium combined cable. So bigger part of it is aluminium, which is very worthless. So it does not give you any value in the market. And if you start burning that cable immediately, that copper that you've stolen loses the quality. So we're trying some of these things, Jeremy.
All right, let me move on to the resurfacing. Again, I acknowledge that you are doing work, but the complaint is that potholes keep reappearing despite the repairs. The suggestion is that you're either using substandard materials or this is just poor accountability.
No, that can't be. We have a world-class asphalt plant in the JRA. We are going through the testing in terms of the... Actually, we have already been given certain approvals in terms of testing the quality of the asphalt that we produce. So it can never be a substandard material. However, what is the challenge? Potholes are a symptom of roads that are crumbling because over the years, for many years, there hasn't been a lot of being done. And then trying to fix a pothole, you are not resolving a bigger problem. That's why then the JRA is going through a resurfacing program. But let's face it, a city like many other cities across the country, they don't have all the money to resurface all the road at a certain time. So the bit by bit that we are doing, we are trying to cover that. Because when you resurface, the chances are high that then you get more life on the road as compared to just trying to fix up a pothole. So over time, and we're also having inclement weather. We have the rain flashes that comes in, and then you know water and electricity is a challenge. You go in some of our communities, people are using, they are using car washes, the water flows the road. You go to some of our suburbs, people are pulling their swimming pools out to the road. All these elements affect the quality of the road. And as the JRA, we will be continuing doing the work. But yes, we will need more money, we'll need more resources to do this. But we are trying, because we'll have to admit that there's not all the money that we require in the JRA. If you see in the past 4 or 5 years, our budget has been cut through the year going forward, because I guess the city is not collecting enough.
So if the budgets are going to keep being cut and that you don't have money, the reality is that the current situation, the status quo, will prevail, and that the problem will only get worse and there will be less maintenance.
That's the possibility. But however, if we keep on resurfacing at the rate we are doing, at least we'll be covering more roads, and then less roads will actually be damaged going forward. So we need to look at it that way. And then, yes, we are always hoping that there can be more funding that comes through our way so that we can do that. But how are we going to counter that? Our asphalt plant is going to a point whereby we will be selling the asphalt plant to the external contractors. In that way, we'll be then raising some revenue, Jeremy. That will then assist for us to be able to do more for the city.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Sipho Nhlapo, Acting Head of Department of Mobility and Freight at the JRA. Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Businesses are evolving at a rapid pace, and communication is at the heart of staying competitive. I think that's fair to say. Whether it's AI-powered automation, cloud-based collaboration, or just a shift to multimodal communication, the way in which companies connect with customers and employees these days is transforming, it seems, by the day. I want to try and make a little bit of sense, and I'm joined by David Menkes, Chief Executive Officer of Telviva. It's a leader in cloud-based communications. David, a very warm welcome to you. So, this week, DeepSeek lands, AI adoption skyrocketing the world over. I'm wondering, though, is it really shaping business communication and customer engagement, or is there still perhaps a degree of reticence?
For most businesses, we are on toddler shoes on leveraging the benefits of AI. DeepSeek's cost structure has caused a whole tumultuous change in the market, with being 20 times cheaper at least than what OpenAI is, and it's going to have a marked impact.
Just in terms of the way in which organizations themselves are adopting artificial intelligence, what's the sense here? What does that trajectory currently look like?
It's rapidly gaining momentum right now. There's about 20% of businesses in South Africa that consume their communication services from the cloud, so there's still a long way to go. But for those that are in the cloud, they've got access to other cloud tools. So those who are in the cloud are going to run faster than those businesses who are not.
Many businesses are investing, David, in something called the Unified Communication as a Service concept. Explain to me what that is and why it's gaining traction.
There's multimodal communication that is in place between people wanting to speak to someone who wants to text someone over WhatsApp, someone who wants to engage over the website, and someone who might prefer to email someone. There's a requirement to pull all those channels together in one system and to be able to talk to the customer and see the customer journey. So you've got a good view about all the engagements with that customer and can service the customer better. And that's what a unified communications tool offers.
And what business advantage does it give?
It enables you to introduce things like personalization. You can give choice of communication to a customer. You could look at the history of engagements with that between you and that customer. And out of that, you can build a profile and know how you can service that customer better. It enables you to do automation and integration into your underlying systems, such that you can follow a self-service approach of the customer, that they can be digital when they want it, but human when they need it.
Do you think then that voice communication over time is becoming obsolete?
No. It will always be there for your more complex discussions where you need more intelligent discussions and more empathy.
We also have a concept called contact center as a service. It's another growing trend. Explain to me what that is and how it improves customer interaction compared to the traditional call center that you and I know about.
It is the same principles, multimodal. It's just designed and built for high levels of interactions, as opposed to where your UCaaS services are generally built for low levels of interactions. So the concept of people dedicated to that task, such as an agent, comes to play. So the tools are built then to service that agent better and enable them better, such as the agent assist part, which is an automation layer where you take knowledge of previous engagements and it prompts the agent to do certain things. So it's got different tools in that particular service.
Providing you're not taking out the human interaction entirely.
Exactly. It is always going to be a part of a human interaction required.
David, if you look at whether it be UCaaS or CCaaS, any organization looking to make that kind of move, how difficult is it, particularly in the transition phase, and what kind of risks are attached to it?
It requires to move into the cloud is not so difficult because generally organizations move from a plain old telephone into something which they just take the plain old telephone to the cloud. And from there, they can expand, land and expand into the other channels. So therefore, it's a natural progression. When it comes to automation, it requires the mapping of customer business processes and customer journeys so you can optimize your customer experience. And there's a bit more complexity in that, and it takes a bit longer. But it's a journey that most businesses would take if they want to end up in a layer where they want to leverage the tools.
And David Makey's, one of the things you've got to be very cognizant about is governance and ethics around artificial intelligence. There are big risks that businesses should be aware of when integrating AI into their communication strategies. I think we know that's true. How does an organization grapple with that problem, do you think?
You point the large language model to the data that the company wishes to expose. So they would have the FAQs as an example, anything which is the content which they wish to share with their customers. And you train the model on that alone. And in that sense, it can't talk to more things than what you offer it to talk to. If you wish to enable the ability for a person to digitally engage with your company's systems, then that sets the guardrails automatically in that process.
And just a final one, overarching all of this is data privacy. Again, do you think that businesses are sufficiently keeping up with existing regulations, for instance, PAPIA?
Generally, businesses have a real attempt to comply. There is businesses who don't, but most of those we deal with do.
But there are still gaps, I would imagine, in that particular. What are those gaps, do you think?
Those gaps are mostly arise out of not having internal systems to automatically purge data after the allowable date, like let's say it's 5 years. So therefore, it's a manual intervention required to do that. And there's gaps that comes in those manual processes.
All right, fascinating insight into the new and changing world of communication for businesses. David Makey's, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of Telviva.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, gaming, I read, isn't just about high-stakes competition or action-packed adventures anymore. There's a new trend. It's called cozy gaming, and it's focused on low-stakes, non-violent, relaxing gameplay that encourages creativity and self-expression. Think soft aesthetics, nature themes, stress-free experiences. It all sounds absolutely marvelous, doesn't it? But here's my question. Is it a niche fad, or maybe there's a bigger shift in how people are starting to engage with gaming? And doing some work on that is Bronwyn Williams, Trends Analyst at Flux Trends. Bronwyn, always good to talk to you about new trends. What's driving this particular one? Why the gravitation towards something that has less stress?
Oh, yeah, less stressful, something you can do by yourself, something that embraces the ladies too. These are all sorts of threads that come together with cozy gaming, as the trend is now being called. One of the main things we see is that as people get lonelier, people are looking for different ways to connect with, if not each other, at least with avatars that feel like you're playing with someone or something. And that means that now women are also getting more involved in gaming, not necessarily wanting to play the same sort of games that men are attracted to. So the cozy gaming kind of fills that niche. It gives them more sort of feminine experience. So that's one thread. The other is these cozy games are often quite reminiscent of the games you might have used to play if you were a child, not to give too much of our ages away, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, right? So this is another thread that's following on here, is this nostalgia that is creeping into particularly people entering kind of middle life or early adulthood at the moment. So kind of looking for the comforts of childhood in a world that feels quite stressful, or to the slightly more cynical, a world that has prevented whole generations from really achieving the markers of adulthood. So there's kind of a regression, a nostalgia, a more feminization, and of course, something to do as we're spending more time at home and less time going out. So new forms of entertainment that, of course, allow us to use our favorite little screens, but perhaps in a way that feels more productive than scrolling through a social media feed, which, of course, these days is often more stressful than relaxing based on the sort of content that you find on those platforms.
Very interesting, Bronwyn, but also a very sad indictment about loneliness in the world, and also rising stress and burnout. And I guess this is some form of digital self-care.
Self-therapy, self-care, absolutely. Checking out what screens, and particularly these sorts of cozy games, are not meant to make you think or to pump your adrenaline. They make you, they're almost designed almost like a meditation, but less spiritual, if you want to put it that way, to get your brain to kind of shut off, to disengage, to almost re-find that boredom that so many of us don't have at the moment, right? Because so much of our attention is for sale and on demand, whether it be for work or through commercial enterprises and advertisers who want to capture that attention. The ability to shut that attention off is becoming a kind of luxury that people want to embrace.
I also read that cozy games avoid aggressive monetization. All well and good, but how is there a financial model here? How are studios making money?
Well, I'm pretty sure the advertisers will be there any second now. Countdown 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Because commerce follows where people are. So I would take that particular element of the trend analysis with a giant pinch of salt.
And are the major gaming companies jumping on this gaming wave, or is it simply being driven by independent developers?
Oh, no, definitely your major games too, and particularly your older games. Quite a lot of people who call themselves cozy gamers are playing games that were available in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. So The Sims falls into this category. It's low stakes, low stress. It's all a little bit silly, but it's a complete escapism, right? So some of these games are old games. Some of them are newer games. All that they have in common is the sense of disconnection rather than active engagement, right? So they are a sense of being able to relax into the gaming world and to kind of escape the stress of life, to play life on an easier level rather than play life on a harder level, which is how we quite often think about gaming. Like you go and you perform a challenge, right? Whether it's a battle, whether it's a finding out clues or solving puzzles, whatever it is. If it requires a lot of brain energy or a lot of adrenaline or a lot of stress, it's not a cozy game. If it is easy, low stakes, low stress, low pressure, without a ticking clock kind of telling you what you need to do next or the threat of surprise, then we're kind of looking at this genre. So think more relaxation, more turning your brain off rather than turning your brain in.
And interesting to see that the rise of platforms like TikTok, for instance, have played a huge role in popularizing this.
Oh, absolutely. TikTok has been such a taste maker. It gives people the ability, I think, first and foremost, to name something that they are doing so that you can then feel part of that tribe. That's probably TikTok's largest sort of socio-cultural influence at the moment, is that it comes up with these hashtags that almost create little communities around them, whether you are a lazy girl or a cozy gamer or a trad wife. I'm using very feminine sort of versions there. But all these things are these sort of labels that you can attach to yourself and therefore feel you're part of a community rather than just someone playing a game alone at home.
And just a final one, and Bronwyn, I'm hoping for an answer in the affirmative, and the question would be, is cozy gaming the beginning, do you think, of a broader trend beyond just gaming to more slower, mindful entertainment experiences?
I would say it's less of a trend towards such things as an absolute yearning and desire for such things, given the impossibility of really achieving that, given the constraints, pressures, and the general design of the game that we are set up to play in our current globalized economy.
So I think time at this point for a lie down, and I'm going to say Bronwyn Williams, trends analyst at Flux Trends. Always good talking to you, and thank you so much. And that's our program for today. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.